Welcome back, everybody. It's Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. As we talk a lot and wrestle with this question of funding in charter schools and the larger questions surrounding it, we invite you to please call in with your comments at 410-319-8888. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Comment on our Facebook page or send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. A lot of you I know have kids in public schools here in Baltimore City who are listening, and we want to hear your thoughts as we talk with Jack Pennell, who is founder of the Baltimore Collegiate School for Boys at Baltimore City Public Charter School, Matt Hornbeck, who is principal at the Hampstead Hill Academy, a neighborhood public charter school in the East Side, Bobby McDonald, executive director of City Neighbors Foundation, which operates three charter schools in Baltimore City, and Rachel Cohen, who's a Baltimore freelance journalist and a writing fellow at the American Prospect, who wrote a huge piece on charter schools for the city paper. Good to have you all with us.
Thank you.
So the lawsuit is what has caught everybody's attention, just because it's on the front pages of the headlines, alleging that it's not following the state formula, it being the city school system, it's not following the state formula in terms of funding charter schools, the amount of money they are supposed to get. And for most people looking at that formula, it's very confusing, not knowing what that formula means and what all these numbers mean, and people get very kind of confused over those numbers. Some have argued, as the Sun papers argued, that that the charters may be right, that they're not getting what's said in the law. Others are arguing that the law is very murky and it's really hard to say what that law means. And then concluding, some people have concluded that if that passes, whether right or wrong, it could mean a disaster for the city school systems in general in terms of the money that they don't have inside the system. So let's very quickly ask Bobby, you're part of the lawsuit. Let me ask you to very quickly describe the lawsuit is, and then look at the kind of the broader issues I think Rachel you raised in the article and what might be missing here.
I think the good morning.
Good morning. Sorry, should have said good morning.
Sorry. Good morning. No. I think the lawsuit is really folks coming together to say that we really need to demand transparency in the use of funds, and that will have a great impact on all the schools of Baltimore. And so, you know, it's an uncomfortable position for the system to have independently operated public schools. That's what charters are. And the formula is important so that we have something consistent and transparent that charters can depend on.
So what does the charter say they're not getting?
I think the important part is really that we can't actually know what it should be unless we come to the table and really have a transparent looking at the books in a transparent way.
Rachel, and what are you saying in terms of what you've been researching and writing about what's missing in this conversation when it comes to this funding?
I think that there are several important issues that are both missing or issues are being conflated. So first of all, when we're talking about the law, there's a couple things that might be helpful to keep in mind. So in 2003, Maryland passed its charter school law, and it said charter schools should get, quote, commensurate funding as public as traditional schools. But they didn't define what that number should be. In 2005, a Maryland State Board of Education ruling said commensurate funding should mean charter schools keep 98% of per pupil funding, and the district holds on 2% to handle central administrative costs. Several years later, the Department of Legislative Services did a survey and found that the 2% figure, it's actually, they found that it's actually closer to 10 to 14%. So what that means, if the district gives all charters 2%, but the cost is closer to 10 or 14%, critics say that means that the district's going to have to take that leftover money that they need to do the work that they have to do from the traditional schools. So that's part of the fight. In 2007, a court of appeals upheld the 2005 ruling, although the dissenting judges in that case said that the State Board of Education doesn't have the authority to set that percentage. So basically, it's been this fight over, can it be determined in that ruling, or should it be handled legislatively? And this past spring, which is really important, Governor Hogan tried to set that number legislatively and put into the charter legislation that it should be 2% for administrative funds, and charters should get 98%. So what happened was there was all of this debate over, well, do we really, like, is it, should we be enshrining this number, given that we think it's actually probably much higher, and the risks of enshrining that into law are, could be great. The charter operators backed the bill. Basically, how they ended
charter up coalition or oh, not sorry. All charter operators, I should say. I don't know if the coalition backed the bill or not.
Sorry. Some charter operators, the charter operators that are involved in the lawsuit currently backed the bill that would have put the 2% figure. And how the state legislature ended up settling this matter for now, contrary to what the Baltimore Sun wrote in their editorial, they authorized a study to be conducted by the Maryland State Board of Education and the Department of Legislative Services that will be that should be issued by October 2016 that would look at all of the districts and try to say, okay, let's solve this once and for all. Like, let's figure out what would actually be an appropriate number for this commensurate funding. And Matt can also speak to this. I know he's been involved in some of those hearing like discussions, but that's sort of where we're at. Like, they have now, and so in terms of transparency for the district, part of the law that was passed this past spring says districts have to pass over the relevant data so that we can come up with a real clear number, and if you don't, we're gonna, like, you know, hold back funds from you. So there's, you know, sticks and carrots in that.
Matt.
Yeah.
So part of this has been kind of seen as a battle between funding for charter schools and what the city is saying in part, city schools are saying in part, is that this is the effect it would have on traditional schools. Even the terminology we'll get to a little bit later. But you seem to see this argument in a different way.
Well, I think there's great charter schools and there's great traditional schools in Baltimore City. And I agree that we've got to get to a point where there is consistency and something that everyone can rely on, because never were we stronger than when everyone, including the Central World Charters, played when we went to Annapolis together, united to get $1 billion for the construction funds. And that was an extraordinary movement. Former Superintendent Andres Alonso and the coalition and lots of traditional schools came together and went with common ground to Annapolis and got some stuff done. In terms of funding for all kids in Baltimore City, I think that, people are doing altruistic, mission-driven work in traditional schools, in charter schools, and we really need to figure out a way that successful charters and successful traditional schools cannot feel an existential threat every year. Sometimes it's said that you just take the $1.361 billion and divide by 84,000 kids, you get $15,000, take 2% off, and it's somewhere in the neighborhood of $14,000 that charters should get. On the other hand, when the district proposes a base amount, per pupil amount of $5,210, you know, the $5,210 would bankrupt and close a number of really great charters. That proposal was recently withdrawn, but that would not do well by charters. The $13,000 or $14,000 would be wholly unsustainable for the district and really put at risk the 71,000 kids in the rest of the district. So, you know, we've been very successful at Hampstead Hill under the current law, and we're very supportive of working with teachers who are members of the union and working with the board as having oversight of charters. But there's the work that's happening at the school and the teaching and learning that's happening at, you know, Hampstead Hill sends kids to City Neighbors and to City Poly Western. And, you know, Jack's school will be having a terrific first year this year. And so there's lots of praise to go around with traditional and charter schools. I'm really grateful that the mayor has enlisted former Mayor Kurt Schmoak to try to bring some gravitas and get everybody back to the table and figure out a solution.
So this is, I mean, the one question you said here that, again, I'd like to probe deeply is the whole funding process and what does this hurt the school system at large or not, if charters get their funding, but also what does it mean for the charters and how and well, there's another definitional piece we'll come to later, but Jack, I mean, you're not part of the lawsuit.
I'm not part of the lawsuit because we're just a new kid on the block, and we're trying to open a school and keep it running and make sure our teachers are teaching and our kids are showing up to school every single day. But I have been involved in this, what I call the charter school movement around the country, and particularly in Maryland. And I think, my deepest concern is that we have traditional schools, and no one can argue this, I don't think, that are deeply poor, intentionally segregated, chronically low-performing schools. And we have too many black children in those schools who are unable to move forward through life and be successful. And our particular focus is on the state of education for African-American boys. And we just opened our doors 5 weeks ago, and we have extraordinary students, extraordinary families, but we also have boys who are reading at a first grade level in sixth grade. And we intentionally reached out throughout, we have kids from every single zip code in the city, and we intentionally reached out to communities like Cherry Hill and so on, so they would have an opportunity. So I think, excuse me, I'm not talking to the microphone, but now I am.
Yes, you are.
and so I really think that charter schools offer an opportunity. I think we have a reasonable debate going on, and a healthy public debate to talk about funding. But I don't want to lose sight of the larger issue. Is like how do we provide opportunity for those who've been shut out of opportunity, who don't have access to opportunity.
Well, I mean, and I think that there's some large questions here to kind of wrestle with. And one of them is, just talk for a moment about this funding issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how should our schools be funded? Should charter schools be funded differently than traditional schools?
I think that's – oh, go ahead, Mark.
No, go ahead.
I think you're getting to the heart of it. And I think that the right result is about getting money to all classrooms. And I think everyone around this table and in the city – cares about that. And it goes to what you're talking about too, Jack. What are we actually serving up to kids? Where are our thriving schools and schools that are getting it done for kids? And I think that the parents need transparency to make sure dollars are spent on kids and they're not getting down and getting caught up at North Avenue. I mean, a charter, like, to work this out correctly, it's not about shifting money from traditional schools to charters. It would shift money from administration to all schools. And that is the point, and that's why we keep harping on transparency. That's what this is actually about. If the 2%, if we come around that table and we say, here's what is right and how it should work in a way, that's fine. I'm not actually caring what that number is. What I'm caring about is that it actually is commensurate, because the way that formula works, money is taken off the top on behalf of all schools. Any restricted funds are out of there. It already says, here's how you handle special ed. Exactly, very clearly, take the special ed money. It only goes to eligible kids. The school system gets a certain amount for being the authorizer. That's the 2%. It's for handling the data. It's for overseeing the charters. And then the rest, the charter schools have power over that cash, and we need that power to be true to our mission and vision.
So power over that cash is different than power you have over your cash?
It's the same. I mean, we get our funding in four quarterly payments from the district, and the salaries and benefits of the staff stay with the district. But it's more of a pass-through. And so we have money that's at our discretion, and it can roll over year to year, which is unlike traditional schools. It's a huge advantage that charters have. But, yeah, that cash comes from the district. It's off their books when it goes to the charter's nonprofit operator.
So 410-319-8888. These are our kids. They're in these public schools here. What are your thoughts? Your children and grandchildren. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, but 410-319-8888. Want to hear your voices. What were you about to say, Rachel?
I mean, I think that everyone at this table, everyone involved in these conversations, I think, wants to do right. No one wants to get less money to kids than they need. I think that the question is, was the transparency that the charter operators are rightfully looking for, was that already in going on? Was that... I think we need to sort of figure out where the state studies that were just authorized fit into that conversation. And I also think that this isn't a question of being pro-charter or anti-charter. I think everyone can look at schools like City Neighbors and say there's no question they're doing really, really important work for the district, providing opportunity. So I just think that you don't want to get caught up in these talking points of, like, are you pro-charter or anti-charter, because that's not helpful, and I think it really distracts from the real issues of but one of the things that is a real issue is what's the long-term vision of the charter movement for Maryland? And I think that actually looking at Hogan's proposed legislation this past spring is an important thing to focus on, because that would have changed a lot of the things that is very unique about charters in Maryland, charters in Baltimore. So I think as we're trying to figure out, you know, what's fair for Maryland, what's fair for Baltimore charters, how do we ensure that all kids get the best that they need, we cannot decontextualize this from the plans that the governor is sort of advancing.
So that's an issue I want to explore partially today and in shows coming up in the future, which is the question of what the future of charters are. I mean, the bill that Hogan put in, unless I'm misreading it, and remember our conversations from back then, is that it would have begun the process of making charters almost independent from the city schools that they get money from, which is part of the battle over how you define what a charter school is.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. It's really autonomy. When you look at other states, one could argue that charter schools in Maryland are not charter schools because of the lack of autonomy. And that's one reason why some of the highest performing charter schools in the country, Success Academy, Rocket Ship Academy, and others, are not coming to Maryland because of the lack of autonomy.
Rocket Ship's doing well right now.
But it doesn't right. matter. But the people
there's some news yesterday were high flying and they're no longer high flying.
Well, but so. So we have people who argue, but it's clear in New York City, it's clear in Chicago, it's clear in other cities that very high performing charter schools, the KIPP charter schools across the country, are high performing, and they do take the very children I'm talking about, kids stuck in chronically low performing schools, and moving them toward college, and that's not something that every traditional school in the city is doing. But it's arguable that the charter schools that are remaining, who by the way, Mark, go under a lot more severe scrutiny than traditional schools. Fair enough to say, Bobby, right?
Absolutely. We hold ourselves highly accountable, and the system holds us
highly accountable,
and that's absolutely for sure. I think, I mean, one of the beauties of Baltimore and our charter schools right now is that, you know, 33 out of 34 of them are grassroots, neighborhood-based, community-supported, engaging, amazing, integrated public thriving schools, and that's a vision for what the public school system can go toward.
And what were you about to say, Matt?
There's some rankings sometimes that rank Maryland 43rd or lower in terms of our charter law, and I have always been an advocate for the charter law in Maryland, and you can look at some of those lists and say, well, we wouldn't want to be like the top states on that list because they don't do very well in terms of their public education program. And I know, you know, Jack's school will be successful with X hundreds of kids, but then there's the larger issue of how many kids are not in charters and what is scalable and replicable. And I find Maryland's law to be really interesting in that it is working with existing teachers and unionized teachers with, you know, you could argue very good salaries and benefits, really supporting schools in neighborhoods, as Bobby said. I think a grandfathering in some schools moving forward, I think that scale is an issue. The adequacy study that Alan Auden is working on for the Maryland State Department of Education, which will be out within the next 18 months, says that the size of the school should be about 450 kids if you want to have gym, art, music, and the varied things that are provided. But grandfathering in schools that are successful right now should be part of the conversation so that they can, we can create a sustainable funding mechanism for existing schools and future schools.
We have to take a break in a few minutes, but I want you to be able to come back, Bobby. But Rachel has to leave at the half hour. Your thoughts before we do that. Get back to Bobby.
Yeah, I mean, I totally I think everyone's been saying really important points, and I think what Bobby said about the fact that the majority of Baltimore charters have been these sort of mom-and-pop integrated schools is an important point that people need to have the conversation about, okay, do we want to keep looking like that, or do we want to look more like other cities? And the question if Maryland wants to change its charter law in order to attract some of the charter management operating companies in other states is one that, you know, should be up for public debate. Part of the reason that these schools have not come is because they do not see the conditions as, you know, quote, hospitable. And one of the things, you know, it's a values, it's a choice of saying, do we want to remove the requirement that charter school teachers be unionized in order to attract certain companies that run charter schools? That's, you know, that's a choice for voters to discuss, for the, you know, the challenges to be weighed, to look at how it's been working in other schools. And I think that that those sort of questions have not been on the table enough. And I think Matt's point about the size of the school is another important detail that has not been discussed enough. Like, what does it mean to have, how do the finances work out when you have a small number of students? We want to provide choice, but how does it work out when we crunch the numbers? So these are the sorts of issues I think that need to be addressed, rather than just are you for or against charters or choice, because that's not really getting at it.
So we do have to take a quick break. I'll come right back to Bobby McDonald to respond to this. First, I want to thank Rachel Cohen for joining us for the first part of the program, Baltimore freelance journalist who wrote this incredible piece in the City Paper, which we will be linking to, and is a writing fellow at American Prospect, and look forward to having her back. Thank you so much, Rachel, for joining us for the first part of the program.
Thank you so much.
Jack, Matt, and Bobby will be back and be joined by some other guests. Stay with us. 410-319-8888. Come on, parents. Where are you? I want to hear from you. Welcome back. It's Mark Steiner. Continue a conversation here that continued during the break, which will bring you all here live.
We hope so.
Well, we will. We will. And that's the voice of Jack Pennell, who is founder of the Baltimore Collegiate School for Boys, a Baltimore City Public Charter School for Boys, and obviously for boys. Matt Hornbeck is principal of Hampstead Hill Academy. Bobby McDonald, executive director of City Neighbors Foundation. And we are joined also now by Dr. Jessica Schiller, professor of urban education at Towson University. And shortly, Kim Trueheart will be joining us by phone. 410-319-8888. Join us with your thoughts and ideas. But Bobby, pick up where we left off here. I mean, and
okay, I think we need to correct the record. So in this struggle, what's being highlighted is that capable and passionate educators and parents can come together, run schools that get great results for kids without a top-heavy system trying to run them. And by bringing in, like, this is about the legislative session, we're conflating that. I do want to talk about the legislative session, but right now the battle, the struggle that we're facing is about money getting to schools. And that there's a lot of folks who will be very happy if we divide ourselves and talk about other things. But this is about transparency and money getting down to schools. And the reason I feel so passionate about that is because I know that when schools and educators, teachers, parents, and kids have a chance to really dream and imagine something, you know, amazing and extraordinary, and then they have control over the funds to make those decisions, you get great results and great outcomes for kids. And I'd like to fight for that for every school in this city. So the traditional schools have cash and services. They can't fight for the increased number of cash coming down to their school. And I think that's what this fight is about. It's about getting more money to schools.
And I just talked to a parent this morning who said, you know, your staff provides for my child every day a love that I've never seen in my traditional public school. I see my boy get out of a car, jump into the arms of great teachers. And there is a difference. There is a difference that happens in the majority of our traditional schools that is happening in our charter schools. I was first inspired by Bobby seeing her school years ago, and I said, if Bobby can do this, I can do this. And so Bobby and I have worked closely together to make our school happen. And I think that there are more people, there are more opportunities to create this. This is, in many ways, a grassroots movement, so parents taking back control of the education of their children. And these are the parents who can't afford to go to our private schools in this city. And you should know that 25% of parents who live in the city, of children who live in the city, do not attend public schools. And when they come to look at charter schools, they say, this is an opportunity for me to go to a public school.
So Let me know the phones here, but also Jessica Schiller, before we do that, you're with us now. You've heard part of the argument so far, so let me let you weigh in, then we'll open the phones.
Okay, thanks for having me, Mark. First thing I want to say is I agree with budget transparency. We all need that. That predates charter schools and this lawsuit, that budget transparency, we've never had a, well, I've never been able to have a conversation and find out the real funding for traditional versus charter schools. And because of that, we all need transparency. But the thing I disagree with Bobby on is that we are divided and the state is the real target. We need to be fighting the state for more money. Hogan decided that he wasn't going to fund the geographic cost of living index, and so now we're all sort of scrambling. And so that piece of it is important, charter or no charter. I agree with Rachel Cohen, what she said earlier, said that's really not the battle. It's not about expanding charters or not. It's about money for the whole system. And the more that we argue for that together and push back against the state, I think the more success we can have for all of us, while at the same time pushing for budget transparency at the city level. But it's a larger discussion about power. And this is, again, it shouldn't be a charter versus traditional school battle, but should be about, you know, everybody should have access to this information and power. I send my kids to Baltimore City Public Schools. I'm a professor of education. I can't access some of this information about my school's budget or the school's budget writ large. There's a lot that I don't have access to, and I should, right? We all should as parents. I'm no different than the parents who send their kids to Pimlico or to any of the schools in the city. So I think that that's really the larger issue. And when we get sort of devolved into, you know, should we have charters? No charters. That distracts us from a much larger issue.
So let me open the phones here and hear and get our listeners to call in to 410-319-8888. And I think just when we talk about this, the $68 million that schools lost, again, I think that's another different political issue that has to do with the fact that one of my adage I use often is that Republicans want to cut government to the bone and will give you nothing. Democrats are afraid to figure out where the money's going to come from so you can pay for what you need. So, and yep. So what happens is our schools suffer under right. those administrations. 410-319-8888. Susan, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Mark and panelists. It's a pleasure to be on with you, and I thank you for covering this topic, which is incredibly complicated. But I want to focus on just one point, and that's the issue around small schools. As we know, City Neighbors, which is my son goes to one of the City Neighbor charter schools, is a small school model with one grade per one class per grade, and it's an incredibly successful model that's created this very warm and loving environment where every child and family is known and welcomed into the school, and there's something to be celebrated and recognized about the small school model. Langston Hughes was a small school that unfortunately was closed. And I don't
it was unfortunate.
Like the idea of grandfathering in existing small schools and suggesting that because small schools may need additional support and resources because of the size, that somehow that's not sustainable, especially given the fact that we know they're highly successful. I think we need to be identifying the bright spots in our city, identifying what's working, and then figuring out how to replicate those working models. And I would definitely suggest that small schools should be in that mix. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, Susan. Look forward to the other callers coming in at 410-319-8888. But I want to get down to some brass tacks here on a couple of issues. Because part of the reason we had this program, and we've had a number of programs, we have over the last 23 years, we've had hundreds and hundreds of programs in education, one of our mainstays. But part of the reason we have this program is because of the protests coming from some of the charter schools and the lawsuit that took place. So I just want to just take a few minutes here for us to parse something out for our listeners. What does this lawsuit mean? Some papers, as I said earlier, said it would be disastrous for the city school budget if the lawsuit happened, whether the lawsuit is fair or not. Is that the case? Do we think that's the case or not? A.
Well, I think that the 2% issue that Rachel raised, if you applied, and I don't think anyone's on either side thinking that this is either feasible or going to happen, but if you applied the 98% of all funds go to charters rule, then it would be bad for the district because you couldn't, there'd be millions and millions of dollars that would have to be added to charter budgets that would come from somewhere. I don't think, though, that that's what Bobby is saying, that the charter lawsuit, I mean, what I won't say it for you, but what you said before, Bobby, was that it was about transparency. I think that the mayor was right that, you know, lawsuits, spending money on lawyers or lawsuits is not good for business or good for the city or good for education. And it would be great if, you know, the parties to the lawsuits set it aside as smoke opens up negotiations. I don't think that's going to happen. Nobody's suggesting that it is going to happen. But that's just my opinion, is that while they're going to be at the table sort of in a good faith effort, both sides ought to be starting from.
I still don't know the answer to the question that many people don't understand yet, and I don't understand, is if the lawsuit went through, even if it's just if the lawsuit went through and won, would that bankrupt the city schools the way they're talking about? That's what I want.
I can answer.
The city school says yes, and charters say no.
Right.
That's part of the bottom line.
Yeah. Since the law passed, and in these past years, we've worked within the framework of the law and with some real collaboration, and we have made that work. No one's gone bankrupt. It hasn't gone bankrupt in any way. It's really been these past couple years where the law was abandoned and the framework was abandoned that we realized we actually need to make this codified in a stronger way. But the formula that is created actually does not bankrupt the system. It is clear about how to handle any restricted funds, how to handle special ed. It will absolutely reveal that the school district spends more on administration than any other district. I mean, it was $150 million in 2012, 2003, according to MSDE. Things like that are going to come up. So that's why I guess I keep saying it is about that kind of level of transparency. But obviously, if I believed it would bankrupt the system, I wouldn't be fighting for it. I think it is really about a commensurate flow, and it is about power. I mean, we have power over cash. Traditional schools have to accept cash and services. And that really is the sticking line and the only comparison there. And that's why I'm just saying it really is about having a clear and consistent formula for how charters are done. But you have an underlying assumption that people have a right, and there's a law that says that this is true, that people have a right to come together, create a charter, go through a rigorous approval process, and then have a consistent way of funding that formula based on that power to independently operate a school.
And I would also say,
Jessica, then come right back to you. Jessica, go ahead.
I just wonder about the strategy of the lawsuit. Can we get that transparency without going the root of a lawsuit? Can we, in other words, not spend the money and the political capital and the time on a lawsuit and push for transparency at the same time? There's no time in my time in Baltimore where that has happened, but why not? Why couldn't traditional and charter school folks get together, organize, and push the system for that same transparency without a lawsuit? I would like to know that.
Well, so I don't understand why people – we are not part of a lawsuit, but I don't understand why people are so nervous about a lawsuit. Lawsuits have been used throughout history to get governments and organizations to think about the rights and what's appropriate and what's not. And I can say, as having sat at the table for 3 years now with the charter school operators, that there has been an effort to do this collegially, to do this with a conversation. And I think that they're at a point that we can't go any further. It's an impasse. And
I'm just suggesting that a lawsuit seems in a system that is trapped for resources seems like not the best use of time and energy.
Jack, you were saying
it's just bringing another third party. I mean, that just I just think of the image of that charter schools, the operators, and Baltimore City Schools. We're in an uneasy marriage, and it's a necessary marriage, and we're at a point that we can't get a divorce. There's nowhere we got to go, so we've gone to a third party basically. I think it's great that Mayor Smoke is involved here to help broke this, but I also think these guys shouldn't stop with their lawsuit because it just puts the pressure where it needs to be. This is the most urgent matter we can talk about, and it's larger than just about the funding. It's about opportunity for children who do not have a quality opportunity every day.
And
this
Jack,
is the most
just,
urgent matter that
we can
possibly.
You just alluded to the fact that they're not charter students or traditional students. They're all Baltimore students.
Right.
And I've heard traditional principals and superintendents and charter advocates and others all say a version of that same thing. So we can't be looking at this from the lens of organizational models or just pure funding issues. You need to figure out how to keep and support and sustain successful schools and build neighborhoods and great schools, traditional and charter, moving forward. And I'm in disagreement with the caller and Bobby on the scale issue, that there is a number, and most of the people who work in school finance think it's about 450 kids, where you begin to see a school that's sustainable in terms of the programming that schools need to have: art, gym, music, library, you know, the various offerings in terms of academics, and the numbers of kids. So that's something that the district has roughly 196 schools and 84,000 kids. And if you look at any of the most successful districts in the nation, you'll see far fewer numbers of schools. Now, I don't want to use an industrial model or warehouse kids or pack kids in. And in fact, Wolf Street Academy is a great small school that's run by the Baltimore Curriculum Project as well. So I do think that there is a role for that. And I agree with the caller on the fact that it might make sense to subsidize small schools in some ways.
When we say small schools, that question is, that to me seems to be a question based on
enrollment,
how we fund our schools, though. You know what I'm saying? About how schools are funded.
Yes.
I mean, if whether a school has 450 students or 2,000 students, shouldn't put the smaller school at risk for not being able to have art, music, and the rest of what we want to have that many schools don't have anyway. I mean, that part of it is just how we even approach
the nature
of schools.
The nature of schools, Mark. I mean, what is the true mission of this school system? It has to be connected to the actual heart and true mission of the Baltimore City school system, which has to be absolutely founded on seeing kids as powerful, creative, imaginative, worthy of respect, right? And then you see the teachers that same way, and then you create environments where everyone can do their best job. And so what we're fighting against, this is systems reform work. What we're fighting against is a way of thinking about standardization and compliance and a system supposed to be running schools. And to do that well, and when they have that many schools, they need them all to be the same at a certain level. That's an old way of thinking about it. It's not getting great results. The reason charter schools even came up is because they're not getting great results. And the new and the real way is to actually have a system that embraces innovation, that becomes a learning organization, that doesn't say every school has to be a certain size for it to work. No, if you have a beautiful model, you figured out a way to get it done on the money that you get based on the per pupil, then you should be able to try that, because guess what? We need all hands on deck. We need a lot of imaginative and creative ways to get it done for kids. If it's some blended learning, do some blended learning. Project-based, do some project-based. This is the way we're going to move forward with a new vision for really having a great public school system. And so when the system talks about there's a magic number and all schools have to be this, I really push against them knowing what their mission is. Because the mission's not to run it. The mission's to create the environment to let folks who care passionately.
And there's no programming dispute I have.
But I think that we know that.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Jessica.
I just wanted to say that, Bobby's right to raise that larger question. I don't think that the system believes, or the mission of the system has never been to value all kids and all teachers in the way that you describe. It's actually to value some and not others. And so that's why we have the system the way we have it. We have charters that, and some public schools that will get, you know, more high-achieving students, more middle-class students, because they are valued. And actually, this push for charters in the first place was in part a result for, you know, the need for innovation and something creative, but it was also a new vision for the city to see if we can create something that would keep middle-class people from moving out. And that's the, I think, the vision of that going forward. So.
Let me jump in because Matt, you wanted to come in, and I saw you shaking your head no, Bobby. I want to come to that shaking no because I think what you're saying is right. People want innovation; they want their kids to have better schools, which is why charters started. But it's also true that part of it is about keeping white families in and keeping middle class families in, and that's a part of the motivation for the schools as well. And for not for necessarily the Baltimore run charters, but for charters around the country, the other motivation was I see dollar signs. I can run a charter school system and make some money. That's also part of it. It's a complex thing. It's not just one. You know, I think that I've been to City Neighbors. I think it's an incredible school. The work you're doing there and how you organize your school, I think it's just amazing. I'm just blown away by it.
But Mark, there's also one fourth category. There's one more category to that. Is that charter schools are awful, or can also be a lifeboat for those kids who are stuck in chronically poor, low-performing schools. That's what's happened around the country.
They don't have to be charters. They don't have to be charters. They can be regular public schools.
If they were regular public schools, that would happen. That hasn't happened in this city. There are too many deeply poor, chronically low-performing schools. And even some charter schools are chronically low-performing.
That's because they haven't been given the autonomy. That's because because of neighborhood segregation. I mean, that's a larger question. It's not because they're not charter schools.
Let me get Matt in here again. If he hasn't said any words in a few minutes, can then come back to Bobby. Okay, Matt?
Well, I do think that you can't talk about the choice that a subset of parents are making without thinking about the responsibility that the district has to at least fiscally look out for all kids. And so, you know, that's the tension here is how do you do both at the same time? How do you support charters? How do you provide the opportunity and autonomy to have the innovation and creativity that that happens at places like City Neighbors? But how do you do it and not have the conversation about improving traditional schools wither? Because you can't right now the philanthropic, political, and policy voice of the 12,000 kids in charter schools is larger in many respects than the 71,000 kids that are in traditional schools, and that's not bad or good. That's just the facts. So we've got to figure out how to make the schools that are working in neighborhoods have the kind of voice that a lot of us have that are in the charter community. One of the things, Mark, that is unique about the schools that the Baltimore Curriculum Project operates, including Hampstead Hill, is we're conversion charters. So there's been a school on my city block for 120 years, and for the last 10, it's been a charter. And so we have a zone.
It's a community school.
Our school, yeah.
Right.
And so the country, site-based management, site-based control are very important aspects of providing teachers and principals with the autonomy they need. And so, you know, that's a piece of the work.
I'm on to interrupt, Max. I want people to understand what you're saying here and come back to our guests before we run out of time. Because clearly we have to have many more shows about this to get to cut through all this murky stuff and get to understand what's happening around this. Is that so your school is a charter conversion school?
Correct.
How does that change the nature of the way you can manage and run your school than somebody who's not a conversion school, but a traditional school?
So there's three ways that it changes primarily. One is that we have a little bit more freedom to hire who we want to hire in terms of teachers. They still have to be credentialed and members of the union. We are able to roll our dollars over year to year.
What does that mean?
If we have any surplus, it does not revert back to the district.
We get to
keep the money and spend it on capital planning or other projects or staff or whatever we want. And then the third thing is control over curriculum and the programming that we offer students in a way that doesn't vary from administration to administration in terms of what's going on at North Avenue. So those freedoms, as you know, you they have them in traditional schools.
So Matt, how much money have have you saved with the rollover?
Oh, because we're a charter, millions and millions of dollars.
Millions and millions of dollars.
You know, Matt, go ahead and give that back then, if you'd like.
Give that back.
So
give it back.
I just charters have the power to decide how money is spent. It has to cover operations, salaries, academics, instructional supplies, our facilities, you know, utilities. Traditional schools have the same amount, but central office holds back more than half and provides services instead of those funds getting to classrooms. We're working with a school on the west side, and I love this school, and I love all the people in it. There's nothing wrong, even in the lowest performing schools. There's nothing wrong with the kids in those schools. There's nothing wrong with the teachers.
We all agree with that.
Right?
But
I'm just saying, in that school, they don't feel like they have the power to push back or to say, I don't want those services. Let us do the work.
So here's the question I have. I mean, and I think this is a much larger conversation. This is why I was trying to get to it, as well as trying to get to understand for our listeners what the lawsuit and what the money is about, which we still don't completely understand, at least I don't. But anyways, and I've been really reading this stuff for days trying to figure it out.
Okay.
But the issue is control.
Right.
And control of our schools and who controls them and how how we design their schools. And, you know, and the other part is we're talking about these schools that are – that have been able to build out, like your school, Hampstead Hill, or like School 64, right? Done incredible work and also been able to build the facility out. That comes because you could raise money for your school. And so did School 64 outside the public sector. You can't have a system that lives like that. You're going to have an unequal system if that's the way we continue going, that you have some schools that can raise tons of money and other schools that can't, then over half our kids or more will be left out swinging in the wind.
Mark, we already have an unequal system.
That's not the point. The point long term is how do you address that?
Well,
we have to address school integration.
I mean,
that is a piece of it. I mean, my school's a third black, a third white, a third Hispanic, and we have working class families and families who, are middle and upper middle class, and it's a very integrated economically and diverse school.
But Mark, I mean, you can also say you have to create a system so that even a school that is high poverty and a concentration of poverty, and I don't think that that's actually great for kids in any way. I think it's better to mix it up. But even that school should have enough funds, more than enough, to create, to dream, and to have the power to decide how that money is spent.
So I don't disagree with that. But the question is, I think we keep pushing for the last 23 years, is how do we get to a system that is that? Let me read this tweet and get a caller. But we're going to come back to this. We have a lot to talk about now in January when the General Assembly session starts.
Excellent. But,
so the tweet from Key of Life, city schools don't care about students. Education isn't a priority in Baltimore City anymore, not since the days of smoke. School leaders and Baltimore City leaders in general only care about power. My husband and I are in the top 13% of earners in the country, and we are moving so far away from Baltimore City as we can. I'm a product of city schools, and I wouldn't dare enroll my children there today, this person writes in. And let's go to Jude, who's on hold. A final thought before we have to take a break. Jude? You there? Is she there?
Okay. How can we make it work? How can we make it happen for all students? So first we have to articulate what we want and desire together. And then we need to look at those conflicts. Is it for all? Is it for some? Right now it's for some. Otherwise we wouldn't have a lottery system in our charter schools. So what do we together want? What are the conflicts between us? And how can we move forward in resolving those conflicts together without violence? Next, hold policymakers accountable for what we want and desire as a united front. Education that's nested in learning, in 21st century learning techniques. How can charter schools be an incremental process in making this possible for all? If they want it for all, then how can they be a part of the conversation in how what they are now can be something that we can all benefit from in the public school system? So we need an inclusive structure for conversation.
I'm sorry, Jude, we're just about out of time, but we had you called in. And it's similar to what Matt was saying even before the show started when we were sitting on the
just green room. We would go united to Annapolis, or that how do we stop the divisive conversation and really get to a place of common ground.
So, and I will say again that I think all three of your schools are incredible institutions doing amazing work with young people. And what I want to see is a city school system where every school system is like that, and I don't have to say, Jack, Bobby, Matt, your schools are incredible, while others are falling apart. You know what I'm saying? That to me is where we have to get to, because I don't want to see 70,000 children coming from poor houses, poor homes in this community, falling through the cracks and ending up in our prison system and not having the life that they should have.
Mm-hmm. We're on the same page. We're on the same page.
That's why Langston Hughes is such a good example.
The closing Langston Hughes, I think, is a pedagogical crime.
Yeah, but the community didn't have the power.
No, they didn't. They didn't have the power. They fought back.
And that's part of it. And then if we have communities like that that don't have the power to make a difference in the system, then they're not going to get the stuff that they need to get.
Jessica, we're out of time. I'm so sorry, but I just want to say...
Oh, sorry.
No, that's cool. How would you know? That's my job. Jessica Schiller, Bobby McDonald, Matt Hornbeck, Jack Pennell, it's been great to have you
here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all so much. We'll come back to this frequently because we really have to wrestle with this for all of our children. It's critically important, and I agree. I think that what happened to Langston Hughes... There's a working-class black neighborhood. They fought their butts off to keep the school open, and they lost, and that was a crime. That's my editorial. We'll be right back to look at race and media. Stay with us.